take, let us assume, a third toke. Long and slow, you vaporize, and you take it in and in and in, and there is a sound like the crumpling of a plastic bread wrapper, or the crackling of the flame, and a tone, a There is this.
You're listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio 93.5 FM CJLY. We're broadcasting live from Nelson and over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaicooperadio.com.
There is a cheer. The gnomes have learned a new way to say who.
Welcome, listeners. This is Fane of the Cosmos, Infinite Moment. I'm your host, Dustin Sunflower. And on today's show, we're going to be interviewing DRC Net's overseas correspondent, Philip Smith. He's in the studio with me now. Hi, Philip.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Good to have you back in the house. So, recently, Nelson has just gone through the election process, and it appears that John Dooley is in for mayor. As a kind of drug war activist, it kind of puts a little bit of fear in my heart, because if you can remember back into the Chronicles of Time, he was one of the counselors who said that there should be a heightened war on drugs when the whole Mayor Thorpe RCMP killings went down. And this was totally in the face of information. CBC recanted on its news stories, saying that the drug war angle, the increased prosecution and ferreting out of growers and punishment of people who are cultivating cannabis, they withdrew their comments, as did the director of the RCMP. But our counselor still went ahead and said that we should increase the war on drugs. So I'm hoping that level heads prevail. Nelson has gone through the democratic process. You have decided. And so I can only hope that an even keel comes with regards to issues surrounding the war on drugs, which in this area seems to be heightened as of late with the introduction of Homeland Security and the Drug Enforcement Agency right into our neighborhoods. So that is of concern, and we will keep our eyes peeled and our ears open for that one. Any of you who were at the David Starfire gig this Saturday, I mean Friday night, whoa, what a wild one, hey? That was just incredible. Some really nice bonger mixes, rare mixes that we get in Nelson. And also some great DJ Lauren bass nectar hits with Craddy mix in there. Freestylers and a host of other excellent show. I'm telling you, I had a contact high of biblical order. Like, I thought somebody had slipped something in my drink, but it was just the vibration. Also, we've been in the membership run. If you are a listener, a fan of the Cosmos, or just a listener of Kootenai Co-op Radio in general, it is this time of the year where we ask you to pledge your beliefs with some cash. Because this radio station is an alternative radio station. It's a community-run operation. We depend on you to make it work. We don't rely upon corporations or fancy donations from here and there. You are our source of sustainability. So if you do not have a KCR membership right now, get one. Today, I heard, was off the map for donations, so keep them pouring in. If you don't have a KCR membership, get one now. Really, they're kind of like a vote for what you want to see in the future, which is community-run radio, Democracy Now, quality programming, not your usual schlock. So here we go. This is going out for all the people who love radio. Here we go.
Above sea level, I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation, the big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night, attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Michael, my dear, come say this about
us. Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. Fuck the apathetic bullshitter, send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Une fois que t'as senti le monde, tu t'allonges sous ton dos.
Yeah.
Tu es là. Tu te manques des brumes. Tu t'enfonces dans ta
vie.
C'est important.
With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level.
Bald Face Lodge is a supporter of Kootenai Co-op Radio.
Local support for Kootenai Co-op Radio comes from Shauna Robertson, registered acupuncturist at the Alpine Wellness Center.
Au Soleil Levant, Artisan French Bakery, is a supporter of Kootenai Co-op Radio.
The Redfish Grill on Baker Street is a proud supporter of Kootenai Co-op Radio.
Welcome back. This is Fan of the Cosmos. This hour of Fan of the Cosmos is brought to you by El Taco Mexican Restaurant.
Woo!
Love it. So in the studio with me right now, I have Philip Smith from the DRC Net. Now, I remember the first time I interviewed you, I got DRC completely wrong. I was like, the Drug Reform Coalition Network.
It's a Drug Reform Coordination Network based in Washington, D.C., but I spend as much time as I can out in this neck of the woods.
Yeah. So we're glad you're here.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, for sure. So recently, as I guess it was part of a DRC Net kind of fact-finding mission, would you say? Or Philip Smith has just been in Afghanistan, right on in ground zero in the country, traveling and talking to different people and organizations. But how did that come to be?
Well, the hook for my trip to Afghanistan was a conference put on by a European drug policy think tank called the Senlis Council. They're based in Paris. And they had drafted a proposal to deal with the opium problem in Afghanistan by diverting a significant part of the illegal crop into the legal global medicinal market. And they had a big conference at a fancy hotel in Kabul in late September that was very well attended, not only by drug reformers, but also by government officials, UN people, people from the NGOs that are working in Afghanistan. It was a very interesting proposal and one that's very well thought out. Clearly something needs to be done in Afghanistan. It's responsible for nearly 90% of the world's heroin. But perhaps more importantly, in terms of the development of the Afghan economy, opium constitutes 60% of the gross domestic product. It's a huge percentage of the national economy. It employs 2.5 million heads of household who are farmers, as well as hundreds of thousands of seasonal laborers. It's the backbone of the economy. At the same time, it's an illicit product that is ends up as heroin going into the veins of European junkies. And not only European junkies, we're also seeing rising rates of heroin addiction in places like Pakistan and Iran. So that was the hook for my trip, to go attend this conference and hear this proposal and see the reaction to it.
So what this proposal would be to divert heroin opiates that would be heading for the streets into a kind of pharmaceutical medicinal model. Why is there room for that?
Well, that depends on what the International Narcotics Control Board says. Currently, the INCB says that the global medicinal market is well supplied, but the Senlis Council, as part of its proposal, looked very closely at the global supply of opiate pain medications, and not surprisingly, they come to a different conclusion than the INCB. They see a huge market for opioid pain medications, especially in the third world, where they're currently priced out of the ability of many people to pay for them. There are currently five countries that can produce opium legally for the medicinal market, and Senlis suggested that Afghanistan become a sixth.
Wow. So what do you know what those countries are?
See, France, Turkey, India, Australia, and I can't remember what the other one is.
Okay. Wow, so not all just... Well, I guess... Turkey, yeah, not all totally American based.
Right, right.
So in Afghanistan, recently they had elections, and they were touted as the great leap forward in democracy, and that everything was tiki-boo with the people in Afghanistan. The Northern Alliance and the Taliban were, you know, no longer, and that the new new democracy was fully instilled. We kind of forget, because Afghanistan fell off the map once Iraq kind of took the picture. We forget that Canada actually does have troops as peacekeepers and as kind of monitors in Afghanistan. And can you talk about that, that part of it?
Yeah, they're part of the International Security Assistance Force. That's basically a NATO contingent of, I think it's 12,000 troops that are in the country. They started out just in Kabul, but they are slowly expanding their presence throughout the country to try and bring basic law and order to what's a pretty wild society. And it's becoming an increasingly dangerous task. The number of U.S. troops getting killed in Afghanistan has doubled over last year. The number of ISAF troops getting killed is also on the rise. In fact, we're seeing new tactics like suicide bombs in Kabul. There was one when I was there. That was the first they'd had in about a year. Now there have been two more just a few days ago that killed an ISAF soldier. He wasn't Canadian, but he was a member of that NATO contingent. One of the big concerns for these NATO soldiers is having to deal with the opium traffic. They do not want to do that. They don't want to get involved with that. That's not their mission. But when I was over there, I talked to people in the ISAF forces, and they said they were as concerned with getting killed by opium traffickers as they were with getting killed by the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. So it's a real, real mess in Afghanistan, and no one has any good solutions that I've seen. You talked about the democratic elections. Well, they were more or less democratic, but if you look at the results, what you see is people associated with the warlords and with the opium trade getting seats in parliament. You see people connected with the opium trade holding about half the governorships of the country. Now, truly, I think for the first time on the planet, we can talk about a real narco state here.
Wow. So how would you describe, like, the opium production before the intervention by the American military and then after? Because I remember in the news, like even years back, the Americans announcing that they destroyed poppy fields and that, you know, they had control over the market. What do you find from before to now?
Well, if you go back 10 or 15 years, if you go back to the 1980s, in fact, that's when you see the initial expansion of opium production in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. And that was associated with the war against the Soviets, and the U.S. and the CIA was involved in all of that. And I'm not going to say that the CIA was involved in drug trafficking, but what they would do is just simply turn a blind eye to what their friends were doing. Now, when the Taliban came, the opium trade went right along increasing, and opium growing went right along increasing until 2001. In that year, the Taliban decreed a ban on opium production, and it was very, very effective. In fact, the only place opium was grown in Afghanistan that year was in the areas controlled by the Northern Alliance.
Well, why would the Taliban bar the growing of opium?
Well, there's a lot of speculation about that. One possibility is that they were under severe pressure from the international community to do something about it. In fact, when that was the only time the U.S. ever gave the Taliban government aid was when they agreed to eradicate the crop, and they got $43 million from the State Department for that. There's other speculation suggesting that the Taliban was well aware that the country had opium coming out the gills, and they wanted to create a little shortage and see the price go up.
Drug war tariff. Yeah.
In any case, they were very successful, and in 2001, opium production dropped dramatically, and then ever since then, it has increased year by year. And now we're doing more than 450 tons a year of opium, and that turns into a lot of heroin. The U.S. has primary responsibility for the reconstruction of the country, but the U.S. commanders and the U.S. Politicians themselves will tell you that they don't really want to fight the battle against opium. In fact, they've dumped it on the poor Brits, who have taken primarily responsibility for trying to eradicate the trade, and as a result, take all the crap from everyone else when nothing effective really happens.
If you look back in history, the Brits have always had a hard time in Afghanistan.
And with opium, too.
Yeah, totally. So, can you talk about how, like, there have been efforts to eradicate poppy fields. Can you talk about where are the poppy fields gone? Or are they moving? Or, like, how does that work?
There has been some successful eradication. When I was in Afghanistan, I went about 100 miles east of Kabul to Nangarhar province. That's where the city of Jalalabad is. I went outside Jalalabad and talked to some former opium peasant farmers there. Now, when I first started talking to them, I asked them if they grew opium, and they said no. And I said, why not? And they said, because the government asked us not to, and we want to help the government. But as we sat down and had our tea and cookies, they're very friendly hosts. And as the conversation deepened, they revealed that the reason they weren't growing opium was because that although they had made big money for them, about $500 a year, growing opium in the past, the previous year the government had come and destroyed their crops without any compensation, even though compensation had been promised. So it wasn't that they were growing opium because the government asked them. They weren't growing opium because the government came and destroyed their crop. Now, that has happened in a very few places. And if you look at a handful of provinces, you can see that there have been dramatic declines in opium production. But that has been more than made up for by dramatic increases in other provinces in the country. It seems to be based mainly on the attitude of the local governor. And as I said a few minutes ago, about half the governors are in the pocket of the trade.
Okay.
So it's going on all over the country. I think in 2002, the first year after the U.S. invasion, it was being grown in 5 provinces out of 34. Now it's up to 29 out of 34.
Wow.
So it's just spreading out all over the place.
Now, what happens a lot of time, like in Colombia or those kind of South American countries where, say, coca production is going on, we hear a lot about the narco traffickers, we hear about the bigwigs, but we very rarely hear about the peasants on the ground who are growing the plants and are in touch with those plants. Can you talk about how opium production, like their general welfare, their living conditions compared to when they are growing opium as compared to when they're not?
And they can make about 7 to 10 times as much money growing opium as they can growing any kind of legal commodity like wheat or rice or things like that. And you've got to understand that Afghanistan has an extremely non-existent infrastructure. So you have considerations like getting crops to market. So if there are, there have been suggestions for alternative development with sort of these boutique crops, but these are crops that require rapid transit in order to stay fresh, and there aren't the roads. I mentioned going to 100 miles to Jalalabad. Well, this is the main international highway to Pakistan from the capital city of Afghanistan. It's like a BC logging road.
Oh, my God.
It took 6 hours to go 100 miles.
Holy.
It's like a BC logging road, except it's covered in 2 inches of dust. And there are giant semis from Pakistan and herds of donkeys and goats and camels from these nomadic Afghan herders. I've traveled a lot around the world, but this was the most incredible poverty and backwardness that I've ever seen in terms of infrastructure. The capital city, Kabul, has 3 million people. It doesn't seem to have a working stoplight. The stoplights are there, but they don't work.
Wow.
And just like the road to Pakistan, it used to be paved before 35 years of war. So this is a country that's just been literally destroyed by these decades of war. And, it really puzzles me. The West has been there for nearly 4 years now, and we've dumped about $60 billion into Afghanistan. I don't know what the hell they've done with it.
Yeah.
I mean, it buys a lot of soldiers, I guess, but they built one highway down to Kandahar, which is the road no Westerner dares to go on because the Taliban will get you on that road. The capital city, Kabul, with 3 million people, doesn't have electricity half the time. There's not been a power plant built in the country since the U.S. invasion. It's just very, very brutally backwards. I don't want to say backwards, but underdeveloped. Actually, the development has been destroyed, as I said, by 40 years of war.
Yeah. Now, I know in Iraq and other places where this kind of lawlessness happens that the safety on the roads, like leftover munitions from previous wars, bandits, that kind of thing. Can you talk about that. Did you see any of that or hear about it? Or
well, when we went to Jalalabad, I hired a young guy who was an interpreter and a driver, and he carried an AK-47 under the front seat.
Oh my God!
Now we didn't have any occasion to use that, but you know that's the kind of area it was. Basically, once you get off the main highways, you are outside the control of the national government. But fortunately, we didn't have any problems. As for minefields, yes, they're everywhere in Afghanistan. When I was there, I went up on this high mountain in the middle of the city in Kabul that sort of divided two parts of the city. It was a real nice place to shoot rockets down on people from in the 90s. And there are mines all over that place. They have marked minefields, at least, thank goodness.
They mark them?
Yes. Well, they have some international organizations that work full-time on that. And unfortunately, they lose people sometimes, too. They get blown up.
Wow.
There is a lot of violence going on, especially in the east and southeast of the country. That's Taliban country, or actually it's Pashtun tribal territory, and that seems to be where the most pro-Taliban and pro-Al-Qaeda sentiment is. That's the part of the country that borders Pakistan. So you don't... You know, I am not a war correspondent, and I'm not 25 years old and full of testosterone anymore, so I didn't go down to Kandahar.
Yeah.
But it was hairy enough in Kabul. As I said, there was a suicide bomb that went off while I was there. There are all kinds of armed forces running around, guys with AK-47s and M-16s and things like that. But that's life in the big city in Afghanistan. My hotel had bomb barriers and had armed guards, perhaps because it was one of the two locations in the city that actually served alcohol, though not to Afghanis.
Wow.
But still, they had received bomb threats over that.
Holy. So, you know, like in other parts of the world, not only do you have competing drug lords, but you also have religious doctrine woven in there. Do you find that, you were saying Pashtun, and do you find any swaying of power due to opium to different sects of people or religious sects? Or are there sects?
Well, opium seems to be an equal opportunity employer. Okay. Everyone is taking advantage of it. And I mean that. You know, the Al-Qaeda, Taliban people are showing up this year with shiny new combat uniforms and shiny new equipment. If you drive around Kabul, you see these nice, very nice mansions going up. These are government officials or warlords, or sometimes they're the same thing, making money off the trade. But you have to realize most of the profits from this trade aren't made in Afghanistan. The Farmgate price for opium is probably $600 million to the farmers, and it's about a $7 billion trade. So most of the money is being made by middlemen traffickers, either going into Iran and Pakistan or going across Soviet Asia into the hot markets of Europe and to retailers in those locations.
Well, and that's those supply routes are not fully covered by the military, I expect.
Well, you're going through these weak states in Central Asia on one route. On another route, you go through Iran, and it's got a 1,000-mile border with Afghanistan that is just rugged, rugged terrain. It's very lawless. The Iranians, when I was in Afghanistan, I talked to the Iranian attaché. He told me that they had lost 3,000 border policemen fighting drug traffickers in the last 20 years. 3,000 policemen killed. And now there's also evidence that this stuff is starting to flow through Iraq and that insurgents in Iraq are also funding themselves with it, as well as apparently going back and forth between Iraq and Afghanistan and taking some of the techniques they learned in Iraq and now starting to apply them in Afghanistan.
Wow.
Thus the increase in the suicide car bombs recently.
Holy.
So it's a big, nasty mess, and no one has got a solution for it.
Let's go for a wee music break here, and then we'll come right back. We're talking with Philip Smith from the DRCNet, and we're talking about opium trafficking production in Afghanistan. And when we come back, we'll talk a little more about that, and then maybe move on to some other areas. This is Rage Against the Machine. We'll be right back.
stop.
Class, but the lesson plan he can't recall. The student's eyes don't perceive the lies bouncing off every fucking wall. Closure is well kept. I guess he fears playing the fool. The place the students sit and listen to that bullshit that he learned in school. Europe ain't my rope to swing on. Can't learn a thing from it. Yeah, we hang from it.
Gotta get it. Put rubber band. Rock the motherfucking rubber band.
Expose and close the doors on those who try to strike or mangle the truth. Cause the circle of hatred continues unless we react. We gotta take the power back.
Take it back, y'all. Take it back.
Welcome back. That was Rage Against the Machine, Take the Power Back. Thank you out to Greg, who just called in to get his membership. If you're really wanting to call in and get a membership, just wait till we have a music break. That way we don't have to break up the interview. In the studio with me is Philip Smith from the DRC Net. And I should just say this hour of Fate of the Cosmos is brought to you by El Taco Mexican Restaurant, just down from the library there. Excellent, excellent food. So get in there.
They got good tacos.
Ah, see?
Claro que sí.
So get in there. Okay. I think, well, what was I going to ask one more thing about Afghanistan? When you were with the people, what was their feeling like? What was their general, like, the outlook on their situation with having a foreign power is in control?
Well, there's increasing discontent. I mean, people were happy to see the Taliban get thrown out. As people in Kabul especially, which is a relatively cosmopolitan city for Afghanistan anyway.
Yeah.
But after 3.5 years and all these billions of dollars and all these soldiers running around, you hear increasing signs of discontent among the Afghans. They're wondering, and what good are all these foreigners doing us?
Yeah.
You know, if you go out and talk to, and these are the people in Kabul, if you go out and talk to peasants like I did, their concerns are far removed from that. Their concerns are getting food to feed their families. And it's interesting to talk to them about growing opium. And they know that it's forbidden under Islamic law. They say, but circumstances are such that we have to disobey Islamic law because we have to feed our families.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, when I asked them about, these farmers had not heard about this proposal to have legal opium production, and their eyes really lit up, and they wanted to know about that. And they said, well, then if that were the case, it would not be against Islamic law, and we'd be happy to do it then. You know, but they do it anyway now.
Yeah, yeah. But that would be redeeming to them. They would, have a free conscience
right,
about growing it. And
not that I think they're really worried about it. I mean, for them, the idea of some junkie in London or Moscow putting heroin in his arm is just totally alien.
Yeah, too far removed.
Yeah, for these farmers, it's pretty much just another commodity, except the one that pays 10 times more than any of the other commodities they can grow.
So is there a timeline for a withdrawal of those troops, or is it business as usual in the foreseeable future?
Well, Afghan President Karzai made a few noises while I was there about reducing the American troop presence, and the American commander said, oh no, we're not ready for that by any means. And it's the same story with NATO. NATO is supposed to be drawing down, but in fact I think it's going to ramp up because the situation is not getting better in Afghanistan. And I think NATO is going to get dragged into trying to eradicate the opium trade, much as it doesn't really want to.
Well, it's ironic that they don't want to, but all through history it has been like that. So
we're probably going to have Canadian soldiers out not fighting just the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but your local opium trafficker.
Holy. Okay, well, on that note, let's steer the ship home here and just talk about some of the recent things that have been going on in the United States. We talked last week or the week before about Denver's vote. Now, Denver voted for the 21 and over ability to possess 1 ounce, right?
That's possession of up to an ounce for adults is legal under the ordinance that Denver voters passed, yes.
Okay, and part of that, too, was that if you were 18 and under, that you wouldn't get jail time, you would get rehabilitation,
community service,
fines,
yeah,
and community service, that kind of thing, which I thought is brilliant because sometimes you bring in laws and you say it's all for adults and the young kids still get screwed.
Right.
You know,
right.
So I was pretty happy about that. But what do you think? Do you think it will be able to be implemented with the federal government so heavy?
Well, I don't think the problem at this point is the federal government. The problem at this point is the city government, city officials in Denver, and the Colorado state government. What Denver officials have said is pretty much we're going to ignore the will of the voters, We're going to order our police to continue to detain marijuana smokers under the state law, not the municipal law. I got to say, the state law in Colorado is not so bad. It's basically decriminalized or depenalized in Colorado. You only get a ticket and have to pay an escalating fine depending on how many times you get caught.
Really?
Right.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there are other places like that in the United States. About a third of the population of the U.S. lives under decrim right now, which is one reason I find it so ironic that U.S. officials scream at Canada about doing decrim when we have it in, you know, 100 million of our citizens live under that regime already.
Yeah.
But in Denver, I see this as a tremendous symbolic victory. I don't see it being actually implemented. I'm not running down to Denver to go smoking pot down the streets, down Larimer Street or something.
I've got an ounce. I've got an ounce. No, no, no.
But, I mean, it's tremendously important. This is the first time any political entity that I know of in the United States has voted not for decrim, not for lowest priority of law enforcement, not for medical marijuana, but for legalization of marijuana possession.
Wow.
And this is, we'll probably see a similar initiative statewide in Colorado either next year or in 2008. And in a state like Colorado, Denver is about three-quarters of the electorate.
Oh, wow. Another thing I found interesting, too, is it was called the Marijuana Alcohol Equalization, which I think that's damn right brilliant. You don't say we're just here for marijuana. We're here to equalize it with the fact that most of the population drinks alcohol.
It's funny you like that so much because when this idea was initially bruited about by the folks in Colorado, The graybeards in the drug reform movement really shied away from it. They thought it was not a tactic that was going to work. But this gentleman in Colorado, his name is Mason Tyvert. He first pulled this off at the University of Colorado with a non-binding referendum and did the same thing at Colorado State University and then took it to Denver. And he's won every time he's tried it. I got to say, he was a little bit sneaky in his campaign. He would have these signs. It was the SAFER campaign, Safe Alternatives for Enjoyable Recreation. Use marijuana instead of alcohol. So he would have these signs up all over the city that said, keep Denver safer. Vote yes on Proposition 100. There's no marijuana did not appear on those signs. He also raised some controversy by doing some advertising linking alcohol with domestic violence. The link is valid. I mean, there is a clear correlation between getting drunk and beating up your wife.
Yeah.
But that aroused some concern from domestic violence advocates who were concerned that the initiative people were taking advantage of their issue.
Yeah, Trojan horsing it.
Yeah. Be that as it may, it got the issue even more coverage and more favorable coverage, to tell you the truth.
Well, I think it's a totally valid point, and for it to ride in on a yes vote on that idea, to me, I was just like, equalization. I want to be equal to someone who gets to have an ale on the deck of their house or even get totally pissed drunk and pee their pants. And, you know what I mean? I want that. I want to be able to do that. No, I'm kidding. But, like, I really like the idea that we're all equal in what we put into our bodies.
And despite what I said about the signs, I don't want people to get the idea that the voters of Denver were somehow fooled and didn't know what they were voting for. I mean, this was in the local media quite a bit in the run-up to the election, and there was signage up all over the place and commentaries and letters to the editor and local TV news coverage.
Yeah.
People voted for Proposition 100 because they wanted to equalize the penalties for marijuana and alcohol. So this is really a positive sign.
Yeah.
Like I said, this is the first time any political entity in the U.S. has voted for legalization outright.
Now, right on the heels of the Denver vote is a recent unanimous vote by Vancouver City Council to adopt safer use of
psychoactive
substances. That's it.
Well, they're basically building on the Four Pillars program, but they've done a couple of really interesting things I think you talked about here last week, but are worth mentioning again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the city of Vancouver is formally calling on the Canadian government, here I got it written down, to create a legal regulatory framework for cannabis. We're talking about legalization. Vancouver is telling the Canadian government to legalize it. But they're going further than that, and they're going beyond marijuana. The city of Vancouver is also formally asking the Canadian government to look at all the drug laws for all the drugs, and here's another quote, and consider regulatory alternatives to the current policy of drug prohibition. Hey, I love hearing this coming out of Vancouver.
Yeah.
I hope they're listening in Ottawa. And we're getting similar things like this even popping up in the United States now. You've got the folks in Seattle who are doing wonderful work, created a model to discuss regulation and legalization. And they have all the professional associations in their neck of the woods in on this. I mean, I'm talking about the State Medical Association, the State Psychiatric Association, the nurses, the lawyers, the dentists.
Yeah.
I mean, people you wouldn't imagine are getting in and supporting this. And this is now going to the Washington State Legislature with a proposal to create a commission to look at studying alternatives to prohibition.
Yeah. What's really good, too, about this is that Vancouver has had to bear the brunt of, we've all heard stories of Eastside and Vancouver addicts and this and that. Really, people in, say, Saskatchewan and Manitoba, and they don't really understand how bad it can get and how drug prohibition hurts people who are in big cities, metropolises. And so for Vancouver to say that is kind of like, we're giving you a heads up, like, we will save you from the imminent disaster that could happen to any big city, any drug using population.
Well, other cities in Canada are starting to listen. Not too long ago, the city of Toronto came up with its own drug strategy. It's not as far reaching as Vancouver's, but it's definitely modeled on the four pillar approach. They're talking an awful lot about harm reduction. In their sections about law enforcement, they basically talk about law enforcement finding other things to do, which I think is really progressive. So we're seeing this take off across Canada. I mean, I'm not saying it's taking off at the speed of a brush fire, but we are seeing progress. And I was recently at the International Drug Policy Reform Conference in Long Beach, California, and I was happy to say that there was a significant Canadian delegation. Almost as much as the Dutch, Americans look to the Canadians to help show us the way on drug policy, along with many other things. So we had not only Canadian drug policy activists, but probably a dozen people from the Canadian government, from various departments, whether it's the Agriculture Department working on hemp, or Health Canada looking at harm reduction issues and things like that. The Canadian government and Canadian activists were both present at Long Beach. So I'm happy to report that.
It's funny, but a lot of drug activists in Canada can't go to the States. It's always ironic that it's like, Drug Policy Reform Conference International. But we can't go, even though it's like right across the border, because they're like, you can't come in here.
Well, Mark Emery was notable by his absence.
He'll be there soon. No, but he won't.
Let's hope not.
He won't be there.
Speaking of people who cannot come, we had one person turned away from the conference. His name is Farid, and I'm sorry I can't pronounce his last name. It's an Algerian name. But he's a French-Algerian gentleman who is the chairman of the European Coalition for a Just and Effective Drug Policy, which is an umbrella group of about 120 organizations across Europe. He flew into San Francisco after attending the Hemp Fair in London, the Wembley Hemp Fair, and he had materials from Wembley in his baggage, and he had materials for the Drug Policy Conference in his baggage, which excited the interest of the customs people. They swiped a CD case and told him that, actually, I saw a copy of the document, they detained him for having 0.0001 grams of cannabis, which they apparently detected with their swipe. He spent about 18 hours in jail, and that was the extent of his visit to the United States.
Drug Policy Reform Conference. God, man. Yeah, I remember there was a conference, I think, somewhere in South America, or even, no, it was Mexico. where it was like, ah, finally we can go, you know. Like, there was a few people who were like, wow, I was able to go down there.
Well, hey, speaking of conferences south of the border, I do want to tell you about what's going on in Latin America. There are things happening there as well.
Do tell.
In late September, I went down to Buenos Aires, Argentina, for a conference of a group called Reforma, which is a hemispheric anti-prohibitionist organization. And we're talking about people like coca farmer groups from Peru and Bolivia and Colombia, harm reduction workers from Brazil and Argentina, drug users groups from those two countries as well. And we met in the Argentine Senate, and we had parliamentarians from Colombia and Bolivia and Argentina and Brazil, and judges from Argentina and Brazil and Chile. Well, our parliamentarians also from Uruguay.
Wow.
And these are all people who are coming together to work on how Latin America and the Caribbean can form a united strategy as a sort of counterweight to prohibitionist U.S. drug policy. And it's all aimed at changing what I like to refer to as the global backbone of international drug prohibition, the U.N. Conventions on Drugs. Those are the conventions that say it's a crime to grow a plant like coca or marijuana or the poppy. So that's happening in 2008 in Vienna at the UN General Assembly Special Session on Drugs. And there's a lot of activity aiming right at Vienna from the reform side. Now, I don't think we're going to overthrow the convention in 2008, but we're going to make a big start at it.
Right on. Was Colombia there?
There were representatives of Colombia there. There was congressman named Pedro Arenas Garcia. He also represents a communitarian and community group movement in Colombia. There were fewer Colombians there than there were obviously Brazilians and Argentines, since it's a ways. Also in Buenos Aires there were no Mexicans. Mexico is the most populous Spanish-speaking country in Latin America, second only to Brazil overall in population. Now, on the other hand, in Long Beach, there was a substantial Mexican delegation. There were also people from Reforma that came up from South America for the Long Beach conference. So we had some informal meetings in Long Beach, hooking up the Mexicans with the other Latin Americans to broaden and strengthen that movement. Now, one of the interesting things about Latin America is we've got a lot of elections coming up. We could very well have a coca grower leader be the next president of Bolivia. They have an election next month. Mexico is going to have elections next year, and it looks like the rightists of President Fox are going to be swept out of office, and we'll probably have a leftist government in Mexico.
Wow.
So, and then we have Mr. Chavez in Venezuela. He's not so good on drug policy, but he is certainly a lightning rod for discontent with U.S. policies.
Mm-hmm.
So while Mr. Bush has been busy trying to wreak havoc in the Arab world, he hasn't been paying much attention to what's going on in his own backyard. And from the point of view of U.S. foreign policy policymakers, things are kind of getting out of hand in South America.
Yeah, and South America is making a lot of economic ties with Asia and
China.
The whole Middle East. So it's America is kind of, it's almost isolating itself.
Well, the U.S. ain't the only game in town anymore.
Yeah.
And the Latin Americans realize this and are playing it to their best advantage.
Yeah. So what do you think was the most, like, exciting thing to come out of that conference?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a huge conference. It was the biggest drug reform conference ever in the United States. There were probably 1,000 people there. There were many, many things going on. It was a three-day conference, and there were 100 different sessions. I mean, I felt bad. Like I needed several clones because there was so much stuff I was missing.
Yeah.
But if you asked me to point to any one thing, I think it would have to be the substantial presence of law enforcement against prohibition.
Leap,
predominantly retired police officers and police chiefs and high-ranking officials. And they were there in their dozens wearing their standout trademark T-shirts that say, "Cops want to legalize drugs, ask me why."
Wow.
So that was really impressive. I mean, you have these silver-haired, distinguished-looking men who have been fighting crime all their lives standing up and saying, "We got to legalize it."
You! What? Ask me a question.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Am I under arrest?
No, just ask me a question. But.
So, I mean, we had guys like the former police chief of Seattle. I mean, these aren't, you know, small-town desk sergeants.
Yeah.
These are some important figures, and hopefully they can start to make some breakthroughs in their own law enforcement communities. You know, I interviewed the chief, Norm Stamper, the former Seattle chief, and I asked him, among his colleagues who were still in office, how many were true believers in the drug war and how many were just along for the ride and the funding. And he said, yeah, of course there's a lot of true believers, but there are all an awful lot who know that it doesn't work, who would be willing to try something else, but who are not going to open their mouths, who are afraid of losing funding or getting fired or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So fortunately or unfortunately, we don't have police chiefs that have the guts to stand up and say this is a waste of time, a waste of effort, and a violation of human rights, and we should do something else. They don't seem to do that until they retire.
Well, I just saw, I was reading an information to obtain search warrant. That's what cops wear as part of getting a search warrant for your house, right?
Right.
And in this one information to obtain search warrant, the cop says, one of the reasons why cannabis is such, or they call it marijuana. I just can't call it that for some reason. My brain's like, no. But he said, one of the reasons marijuana is such a great thing is, one of them was low risk of severe punishment, which I thought was a real bad crack at the court system. Like, and then the laissez-faire attitude of the public, the press, and the government.
Now, is this an affidavit for a search warrant or an op-ed?
For a search warrant. Yeah, exactly. I'm going, but what really perturbed me was, how can a police officer who's a public servant say that, sorry, the people are wrong? You can't tell us what to do.
Well, we see that all the time. Every time in the U.S., for instance, in the Denver vote. I mean, it's funny. You have the police up there opposing it very strenuously and saying they're not going to enforce the law. And then once the thing passes, they're still not going to enforce the law. But now it doesn't matter anymore because we're not going to enforce the law. So it makes me wonder why they were opposing it so strenuously before.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things where it really actually gets me very upset is when police officers say, we're just here to uphold the law. But when we want to change the law, they're like, we don't like that law. But well, you're supposed to uphold the law. We don't like that law. You're supposed to uphold the law. You know, like, it's a real, it really gets me.
Well, they're supposed to be public servants.
Public servants. Let's say that again. Cops are public servants.
That's the idea anyway.
Everybody at home, please say that three times. Cops are public servants. Remember that next time you're talking to a police officer. They're there to help you. They're supposed to help you. They're not supposed to be judges, policymakers. They're supposed to uphold the law.
That's right. They're supposed to enforce the law, not decide which laws are valuable or worth enforcing.
Mm-hmm. Or comment on health issues or, you know what I mean? Like,
well, your officer with his warrant application there was just totally out of line.
Well, and that's going to be an argument, I think, for me is how can an officer who's swearing a warrant who actually shows a contempt of the court by saying there's a low risk of punishment, how can an officer be deemed worthy, trustworthy enough to what else he says if he's in contempt of court?
Right, right.
So anyway, we'll see how that pans out.
The officer certainly has the right to have his own beliefs on a policy matter, and if he has beliefs that have him concerned, he should talk with his elected officials to do something about it. That's the democratic process.
Exactly. So in the States, too, a bill that's online here, I just got to want to get the exact wording of it. It's the Drug Testing Integrity Act, and it's set to be voted on by Congress, and it's an act that would limit all selling, marketing, online purchasing, production of anything to do with drug testing to help you pass drug tests.
Yeah, well, I call it the Drug Testing Industry Employment Act.
Yeah.
This is an act that was drafted at the behest of the drug testing industry. That's clear if you look at the legislative history of it. Now, if it ever comes to a vote, I think it will probably pass easily. We can only hope that the U.S. Congress is too busy trying to figure out how to fund its deficits and fighting over the Iraq War to ever get around to it, which is entirely possible. Now, this is already the law in a handful of states in the U.S., and this is, as I said, an effort by the drug testing industry to extend this across the country nationwide. You know, there are better things to do with your money than waste it on drug testing. If you are worried about people doing drugs on the job, test them for impairment. If you're worried about drug drivers, test them for impairment. Can they stand up and walk a straight line? Can they count to 30 backwards? Can they touch their finger to their nose for drivers? You know, there are similar tests you can find for any particular set of job skills. Test impairment, not the presence of metabolites.
Yeah, I cannot remember which company it was, but I'm thinking it was General Electric, decided to test the drug test. And what they did was they went and they drug tested all their employees. But what they did was they analyzed what the employees did, how many sick days they took off, what their position was, how did they work with others. And then what they did, because they're a corporation, they analyzed it from every angle. And what they found was that if they were to have gotten rid of all the people who tested positive on their drug test, that their company basically would have eliminated all the quality people within the corporation, and that it probably would have caused it to crash. They found that the people who tested positive were most liked by their fellow employees, were most likely to come up with new ideas, had less sick days than other employees, and were generally happier in their workplace. That was what they found when they did their drug testing. And so you know what they did? They just put the tests and they just got rid of them. You know what I mean? They just got the results and they said, okay, you know, people are like, what's happening? And they're like, nothing.
Well, they behave as you would expect a company to do. They are not driven by moral panics or anything like that. They're driven by the bottom line and by what works and what's effective.
Yeah.
And what they found was it didn't make sense for them to drug test people and fire people who were productive employees.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned that. That's kind of a microcosm of the whole broader issue of what we want from drug policy. In the United States, at least, the reflex answer is we want to reduce drug use. Well, in this example, GE looked at the results of their study of drug use and drug users in their workforce and found out that, maybe that wasn't their highest priority. You know, maybe GE was more interested in making money than reducing drug use. But more broadly, as a society, what are we interested in? If our primary measure of success in drug policy is reducing drug use, that means more cops, more drug testing, more repressive laws, repressing it however we can. But if we as a society have other goals like increased quality of life, less crime and violence and things like that, perhaps we'll come up with different drug policies. So what I'm trying to say here, however awkwardly, is we need to refocus our efforts and our attention on what we really want a drug policy to accomplish.
Yeah, a better life.
A better society for all, yeah.
Oh, man.
And prohibition doesn't do that.
No, not at all. And and if this law was to go into effect, this piss test crackdown, it's just like Operation Green Merchant and the whole thing with Tommy Chong going to jail for 9 months. And it just, it's a further escalation. But not only that, it's a huge damage to the to companies and corporations and people who, those employees who do those take those piss tests. Well, you had a good word for it. Piss passer? No, I can't remember what you called it. But you're immediately, those people will be, they will be fired. Like, I know lots of people who buy drug tests who are like, I'm not going to stop smoking pot.
Right, right.
You know, and so that person will be fired.
Those people will be fired. Other people will leave lucrative jobs rather than quit using the herb.
Like for me, I remember going to the States before I was banned, and I remember seeing signs in stores that said, all of our employees are drug tested for your satisfaction. And I'm like, my satisfaction? You know what I mean? Like, sorry, they're drug tested, but it's okay if they're alcoholics or, like, you know what I mean? Like, that they're safe within your thing. After that, I'm like, I'm not going into any store and buying anything from someone who piss tests their employees.
Yeah, well, this is not about safety or public security or anything about that. It's about reducing drug use by any means possible, by any means necessary.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how offensive it is to the sensibilities of the citizenry or to the spirit of the Constitution of the United States.
Wow. I always say, if you want to take a piss test, say ah. That's
well,
fine. Open your mouth and you can test it out, because that's the only way you're going to get it out of me.
Well, I always like to quote the renowned social philosopher and songwriter Mojo Nixon, who wrote a song about drug testing saying, I ain't gonna pee-pee in no cup unless a Nancy Reagan's gonna drink it up.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yo,
on.
Nancy.
Mojo Nixon and Skid Roper?
That's right.
Yeah, I love those. I'm gonna have to find that song. Play it on the air.
Inspirational music.
Okay, so let's maybe go to a song and then we'll just wind it up quick.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to have to get out of here. But
okay.
Before we go, I want to say I'm not a slick radio announcer, but I want to put a plug in for community radio here. I've lived a lot of places in North America, and I've lived a lot of places that didn't have community radio, and a handful of places that have. And you folks here in Nelson perhaps don't understand how good you have it by having community radio. And it doesn't pay for itself. So if you're listening now and you're enjoying what you're hearing and you're finding some use for it, I hope you're going to call up the station and become a member and help support this very worthy local initiative.
You're here. Okay, well, it's been nice having you in the studio always, man. I'm like, whenever there's a chance for you to come in here, I am so pumped.
I'm always happy to do it.
Great, great. So in the future, we're going to have Philip Smith in the studio.
Live
from DRCNet. So, do you want to do just one plug quickly for DRCNet? What's their web address?
Yeah, that's the Drug Reform Coordination Network. We produce, among other things, the Drug War Chronicle, which I write. And that gives you all the drug policy news from around the country and the world. You can go to www.stopthedrugwar.org. And that'll put you to our homepage, and you can explore from there.
Right on. Blessings, and we will have you in soon.
Thank you.
Enjoy the coots.
As always.
Okay, here we go.